Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Okay. So this morning we'll carry on with the Prabhupada, the Living Bhagavatam seminar on the topic of the art of managing. And yesterday we looked at four aspects that Prabhupada described which are necessary for a manager. Just to remind everybody, to do all things at once, that's one. In a nice manner, that's two. And whatever is practical for preaching Krishna consciousness, that's three. And keeping the high standard routine practices for one's own advancement, that's four principles, on which Prabhupada said constitutes the art of managing. Management is not just those things, but these are some items that Prabhupada himself identified, and especially within the context of a voluntary movement like ISKCON, a spiritual movement, then these things are very, very important to observe. And going on from that then, another letter that Srila Prabhupada sent out, this was in August of 1974, to a devotee called Batu Gopal, where again Prabhupada uses that same phrase, the art of management. So he says, regarding the art of management, constant changing is not good. Even if there is some fault in the management, it should be corrected, not changed. Besides that, Vaishnava philosophy is that every person is addressed as Prabhu or Master. Everybody should consider himself to be the servant of the other, and then that will make the management very nice. So that's another item that Prabhupada sometimes complained about, especially with his Western disciples, that they always want to change everything. You build something up and a few minutes later you tear it down and build something else. This business is going on, we see in Western civilization, constantly putting up big skyscrapers, and then after 30, 40, 50 years, then they have to pull them all down and start all over again. So, in our philosophy, nothing changes, at least spiritually. The spiritual philosophy is the same. 5,000 years ago when Krishna spoke it, it's the same philosophy that he speaks today, or that his representatives speak on his behalf. So in that sense then we don't change. And Prabhupada was not very keen on change, of course from practical purposes also. I'll give one example. I don't require that to be adjusted. I'll adjust it myself. You're not me. Sometimes you can serve too much. Yeah, when it's required, that's all. So one example of a change. The original Los Angeles temple, Wat Seeker Avenue, the one that we have now, that was the first big temple in ISKCON. It was the first big building that Prabhupada purchased. And when he got that complex there, actually they got the church, it was formerly a church. They bought that building and then they bought several apartment blocks all around it. So initially Prabhupada named that the world headquarters of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And his plan was to sit down in Los Angeles, train his disciples up in deity worship in the new temple. He invited all the temple presidents to come from all around America and spend 1 month in Los Angeles to get trained up in the art of deity worship. and also to refine their sadhana. So he wanted to make Los Angeles into a model temple. And he had plans there to stay there himself. When Prabhupada went to the West, he never actually intended to come back to India. He had to come back in 1967 because of his health. He had that heart attack or stroke. So he had to come back and spend 6 months getting some treatment. But then at the end of 67, he went back. And his intention was that he would stay in the West and never come back to India. That was his mission, to preach to the Western peoples, or the English-speaking peoples. And his idea was that he would settle down in Los Angeles, he would translate his books, and his disciples would be trained, and they would train others how to manage this very rapidly growing movement that he had created. However, in 1970, things took an unexpected turn, or maybe not unexpected, depends on who you are and what your perspective is, but things took an apparently adverse turn. There was some unusual goings on in the society which Prabhupada felt were minimizing his position as the Acharya, founder Acharya. It got so bad that by the middle of 1970, Prabhupada had to leave Los Angeles. And I say had to, because even then he wasn't really keen on it. But somehow or another, he said later on, Krishna forced his hand. He created this situation arose where Prabhupada felt that there was some disrespect coming into the society towards himself as the founder of Acharya. He knew where it was coming from, but he saw that some of his leading disciples had become affected, and it became very, very unpleasant how to deal with that. And so Prabhupada called one or two of his GBCs that were, he felt, loyal, and they came to Los Angeles. And then he explained the situation, then he asked them, now what to do? I have to leave this place. That was his conclusion. I have to leave Los Angeles. So I think Tamal Krishna Maharaj suggested, well, you can go to Florida maybe. So Prabhupada said, no, not far enough. So then he said, well then, because Tamal had been preaching in Europe for some time at that point. And so he said, well, you could come to Europe. And then Prabhupada said, no, not far enough. And then finally it was decided the only place to go was back to India. And when Prabhupada left Los Angeles, the small deities of Rukmini Dwarkadish were there, he went before the deities and he was crying. And he was saying that, I don't know why you're sending me back to India. I came here to preach in the West, that was my plan. But now obviously you have some other plan. So he was actually crying that, I don't know why you're sending me back to India. But he accepted this as Krishna's arrangement. And of course, shortly after, he came to India in late August began officially the preaching of ISKCON in India. And then things took off in a very amazing way. You know, it caused a sensation. And of course, ISKCON started to grow very rapidly in India. And then Prabhupada started to spend most of his time in India rather than in the West, because he'd got some men that were trained up in the West, so he left them with the management so that he could personally supervise the growth of ISKCON in India. And there were good reasons, of course, for that, because Prabhupada's Western disciples had never lived in India before, and they had no idea how things worked here, what the culture was, and especially at the same time, their Krishna consciousness was not very mature. So spiritually and materially, in India, they were a little bit, what we say, all at sea. Yeah, where you get tossed around by the waves and you can hardly, you know, sit on the top. So Prabhupada knew that in India he would have to personally manage everything. He was the only one that was expert enough to understand, you know, all the underlying principles of how to deal successfully in India and not get cheated. It's a very important point, because this property, Bombay property, Mumbai now, that was a classic example of how there was an attempt to cheat the devotees. The land was advertised for sale, Prabhupada saw it, he liked it, some deposit was put down, and he left some of his senior men, Tamal Krishna, Brahmananda came in for some time, Giriraj was here for some time. He left them to manage the development of this temple. And I mentioned yesterday how when they came on the land, they were living in tents. There was no facility. And Radha Rasbihari was living in a little tin shed. And that was ISKCON Bombay at that time. But Prabhupada, somehow or another, later on detected that the fellow that was selling the land to us was actually a cheater. He said initially when he got it, he took the decision to buy the land and committed himself and gave some money. He thought the man was a nice man. But then later on, not so long afterwards, he understood that there was a ploy to try to cheat Prabhupada out of the deposit money and throw us off the land. But they didn't know who they were dealing with. So at one point, this struggle was going on, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj and I think maybe Brahmananda, they had come back, they'd come here to Bombay to try to settle the transaction. And this man had them so bamboozled by the legalities of the thing that they actually came to the point where they gave up trying to settle the deal and actually handed it back to this gentleman, Mr. Nair. So they actually gave up on it and they gave it away. And they actually even, you know, came to the conclusion that we'll not even get our deposit money back. So Prabhupada, I think, was up in Ahmedabad at that point. When he heard what they'd done, then he immediately came back down to Bombay and then he started fighting again. And he wouldn't let go until this man, actually he died, Mr. Nair. Prabhupada said that he was insulting Krishna and I could not tolerate that. So I prayed to Krishna, please remove this man. It's not something that we normally do, but he was insulting Krishna, and therefore Prabhupada felt justified, this man has to go. But then his wife continued with the fight, and then Prabhupada had to deal with her. So it took several years to get this whole entanglement fixed up, and only Srila Prabhupada could do it. His disciples had got bamboozled, cheated, and lost. Prabhupada stepped back in and revitalized everything. So he had to do that here in Bombay, he had to do that in Vrindavan, he had to oversee everything in Mayapur. So the whole ISKCON Yatra in India was dependent solely, I can say, on Srila Prabhupada himself, personally being involved in every detail of the management. So Prabhupada anyway, he was an expert manager, he knew what he was doing, he knew that we didn't know very much. But one thing that he noted as I was beginning this class with was that the Western devotees, they had this very bad habit of always changing things. Get back to why I mentioned Los Angeles. So in 1976, when Prabhupada went back to Los Angeles, remember that was his number one temple in the West. He had been personally involved in purchasing it and setting it up, setting all the standards for deity worship and sadhana and forming the ashrams. Even the purchase of the apartment buildings across the road, that was instigated by Srila Prabhupada. So he had a lot of personal investment, if you like, in that building in the Los Angeles Center. And when they first got the temple there, there was one big meeting hall with rows of seats like in a church. And then there was a smaller room in the center of the building. So Prabhupada didn't choose the big room as the temple room. He had the deities installed in the smaller room. And then the big room he was keeping as a kind of a hall, so that his idea was that people would, they would advertise seminars and classes. They would invite the public to come. And even they wouldn't have to take off their shoes. They could just come in, they could sit on the seats, and then they would use it as a lecture hall. So anyway, Los Angeles temple kind of grew very rapidly, and they soon saw the need for a bigger temple room. So Prabhupada agreed, I think in 74 or 75, that they could move the temple room to the big lecture hall. And that's the temple room that's there right now. So that was not the original temple room, but it became so. So they set everything up very nicely, very, you know, opulently. They had all this green onyx marble that they shipped in from Mexico, you know, nice marble columns. And they had this nice altar, three altars for Gaunatai and Rukmini Dwarkadish and Lord Jagannath. And above the deities, they put these nice canopies, cloth canopies. And they looked very nice. Prabhupada liked them. So that was in 75. So then in 1976, when Prabhupada came back, as it turned out it was his last visit there, we came there on June the 1st and we stayed for 11 days. So when Prabhupada came into the temple room, they opened the deities. It was a special darshan. We arrived late at night from Hawaii. We got to the temple maybe about 9 or 10 o'clock at night. So they kept the deities open so that Prabhupada could have a darshan and Rukmini Dwarkadish could see their pure devotee. So the next day or 2 days afterwards, Prabhupada called the managers into the room, his room, and he complained to them very strongly that you've changed everything. And what they'd done, the cloth canopies that were above the deities, they decided this is just cloth. You know, the rest of the singer sands are nicely carved, so we should have some nice, very opulent covering over the top of the deities. So they replaced the cloth canopy with a wooden canopy, individual wooden canopies. And those wooden canopies, they actually bought some tens of thousands of dollars worth of gold leaf, real gold leaf. And they pasted all the wood with gold leaf, so they thought this is going to look very opulent. So when Prabhupada came, and then he had the darshan of the deities, and then he looked up, he saw the cloth canopies that were there the previous year, and now being replaced by these gold leaf wooden canopies, and he didn't like it. So he called them in the next day, and he told them, why have you done this? You changed this without asking me. He said, the other canopies were very nice. I liked them. He said, now these wooden canopies, you say that it's real gold leaf, but he said, I think it looks just like some cheap painted wood. So he wasn't happy with it at all. And then he quoted this little song that I guess he had learnt when he was a kid in Bengal, that do something new, do something new. If you have to stand on your hands and clap your feet, but do something new. So he said, this is your Westerners, you're always changing. You're never satisfied with what you've got. He said, whereas our philosophy is that we do not change. Because when you're dealing with the material world, change is inevitable. Even if you don't want to change, things change around you. So that's inevitable, and Prabhupada knew that. But Prabhupada didn't like the idea of his disciples wanting to change things all the time. Because once you start down that road, then it's endless. You change this, then you change the next thing, then you change the next thing. Before you know where you are, you've got nothing left of what was originally there. And there's this constant change going on. So Prabhupada was against that in management. His idea was that people come along, somebody has some capability for managing something, or they have some ability. So let them do that and let them develop their expertise in that particular field. Even if they make mistakes, even if they don't know so much at the beginning, but they'll learn. Now, if somebody makes a mistake after some time and then you dismiss them, then you have to find somebody else, try and find somebody else who's more qualified. And at the same time, you've lost all the time and energy that you've invested in the other person. Whatever they've learned, now if you dismiss them because of some mistake, then, you know, there's a gap there. And that person's training now has become useless. And you're not getting the benefit from it. So Prabhupada's philosophy was to reform, not reject. That was a little mantra you'll see in some of his letters. Reform, not reject. Yeah, that as soon as somebody makes a mistake, even if it's a serious mistake, don't reject them. Keep them connected. Keep trying to engage them in the way that they're expert. And we see that quite strikingly in the way that Prabhupada dealt with some of his leaders in the early 70s. In 1974, I think either 4 or 6 GBCs all had fall downs, and quite serious ones. There was one sannyasi. Prabhupada had given him sannyas, Bali Madan Prabhu. And for a couple of years he was doing amazing preaching in the Southeast, Asia, Australia and all that area. And he was running the BBT Press in New York. And he became one of the first GBCs. He was one of the first BBT trustees also. So he took sannyas, but out of some sentiment apparently. And then after a year or two, then somehow or another he got entangled with this lady that started coming to the New York temple, and he became completely bewildered by this lady and started having a relationship with her. So Srila Prabhupada, I mean, this is one of the leading devotees in ISKCON at that time. He heard about it, so what did he do? He personally performed the Vivaha Jagya for Bali Mardan. From being a sannyasi, he made him a grihastha. He personally did the fire sacrifice for Bali Mardan's wedding, and he initiated this lady that had captured one of his leading men. And then he kept him in his service. So even though he changed from being a sannyasi to a householder, he had a certain capability by his nature. He was a good manager and he was an intelligent man. And so Prabhupada didn't want to lose that, the benefit of his service, and he didn't want to lose, you know, a dear disciple who had done some significant service for him. So he married him and he kept him in his position. And that was, you know, an attempt to, all right, adjust the situation, but not lose, you know, the abilities that this man could offer. Because by the end of the year, there were other complaints that started coming in about his behavior with his wife in the New York temple. So eventually he had to resign. Or it came to the point where he realized he had to resign. Even then, Prabhupada was reluctant to remove him. His idea was, all right, suspending for some time, and let's see if we can't rectify him. So that's one example. Another example, the first time that kind of thing occurred, was with Rupanuga Prabhu. Again, he was one of the early leaders of the movement in America. He did amazing preaching in Buffalo University. About 14 or 15 students that were attending his accredited Bhagavad Gita class at the Buffalo University, I think in 1968, they all became full-time devotees, and many of them became leaders themselves. So Rupanuga was, you know, considered one of the very advanced devotees. So he also took sannyas in 73. But then very quickly afterwards, he felt that he'd made a mistake, but then he'd taken a step that he couldn't, you know, step back from. So he started having some meeting with his wife again. And then after some time he realized that he couldn't maintain his sannyas vows. So he actually resigned and he left the temple, the immediate temple vicinity, and he was living back with his wife somewhere nearby. And then he wrote to Srila Prabhupada asking what his position is. So Prabhupada didn't chastise him. Rather, he said, no, you stay where you're comfortable. If you wish to be with your wife, that's all right. But don't give up your service. You are still the GBC. And so Prabhupada maintained him as a GBC, even though he had that change of ashram. So this is a couple of striking examples. There are many others, but I think the point's illustrated there, that Prabhupada valued everything that a person did, any service that was being performed. And as a manager, he wanted to sustain whatever was done. Even if there were some mistakes made, but there's always some good that's there as well. So his principle was to see the good in the person and try to engage them to bring that good out. Yeah, keep them in a positive frame, keep them connected to Krishna. And if they keep that connection, not be cut off because they've made some mistake, then gradually, then sadareva samantavya. They'll remain as saintly persons. Their behavior will eventually be rectified by the process of chanting and engaging in devotional service. And then, you know, they'll come up to their full capacity. So that was Prabhupada's idea. Of course, that doesn't mean that, you know, absolutely nobody can ever be removed if they're doing something, you know, which is not correct. Sometimes you're in a position where you have to change a manager because they're causing so much, the behavior is causing so much disturbance that many other devotees are being affected by it. In that kind of circumstance, then you have to try to figure out a solution. And it may not be that you can keep, you know, everybody who's made a mistake in the same position. That requires a little expertise to know how to act. The preaching of Krishna consciousness, there's principles and there's details. Prabhupada explains that, I think, in the Nectar of Devotion, that there, Rupa Goswami gives some principles of Krishna consciousness which must remain the same at all times. But in preaching Krishna consciousness to, you know, in the material world, you're also guided by time, place, and circumstance. So the detail of how to preach Krishna consciousness, that has to be worked out and adjusted. The idea of preaching Krishna consciousness is a principle. It must be done. Krishna says that. Whoever explains this message of Bhagavad Gita is the most dear to me. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also says, you know, go out and preach this message of Krishna to whoever you meet and become a guru. So preaching is a principle. But how you preach, that depends on the time, place, and circumstance to a large extent. And a manager has to be expert enough to know how to make adjustments. So Shrutakirti Prabhu, another great personal servant of Srila Prabhupada, he once asked Prabhupada that how do you tell the difference between a principle and a detail? Sometimes it's confusing, so how do you tell the difference? So Prabhupada told him, he said, that requires a little intelligence. So it's not cut and dried, black and white. Every situation has its own, you know, special nuance. And a manager, therefore, has to be have the expertise to know when to maintain something and work to improve it and when to actually change something. But in general, as he says, the art of management, constant changing is not good. So he doesn't say any change is not good, but constantly changing, that's not a principle. That's, you know, not one of the items of good management, to always be changing, you know, one thing after another. And then, of course, he adds this note at the end there. He says that our philosophy is that everybody is addressed as Prabhu or Master. Everybody should consider himself to be the servant of the other, and that will make the management very nice. So I mentioned that a little bit yesterday, that the managers, it's not now that we've taken a role as a guru or a GBC or a temple president or a Sankirtan leader or a head pujari or a chief cook. You know, we get some title. But that doesn't mean, you know, that we're extraordinarily qualified now. Now I've got the title, everybody must bow down before me. That's not the mood. Now you have, as a manager, the opportunity to increase your service. Yeah, not to increase service to yourself, but to increase your service to others and encourage them to increase their service to others. Everything is based on service. Everything is based on seeing myself as the servant of all of the other devotees. And therefore, Prabhupada said, I introduced this system where we refer to each other as Prabhu. Yeah, because that means automatically now, you know, I am your servant. We were on a morning walk, actually, around about the 26th of March in Delhi. Prabhupada had just come over after celebrating Gaur Punima in Calcutta, in Mayapur and then Calcutta. And then he came to Delhi, and we were having a couple of days pandal programs at the house of this gentleman called Lakshman Agarwal. He had a big company at that time making light bulbs. Sylvania Lakshman. So some of you may remember. I think they're bankrupt now. But anyway, he was a nice man. He had Prabhupada come and stay at his house. And he set up a pandal there was like a grassy reserve in front of his house. The place was in Chanakyapuri, so it was a very opulent kind of setting. So every day Prabhupada was going out for his morning walk, as he always did, and we were discussing different aspects of free will. I won't go into all that right now, but during the course of the conversation, Prabhupada got to the point where he explained this system of serving others. Yeah, we serve the Supreme Lord, and on his behalf, then we offer Krishna consciousness to those, you know, who may not be so qualified. So in that way then, Prabhupada explained, this is the mood, Prabhu. He said, therefore I've asked you all to refer to each other as Prabhu. But he said, it is not that... Now Gurudas Swami was on the walk, so Prabhupada looked at him, he said, it's not that now Gurudas Prabhu, come and clean my shoes. He said, then what kind of Prabhu? It should be Gurudas Prabhu, can I clean your shoes? So it's a nice example. Not that now I'm a big manager, I'm, you know, superior to everybody else, you come and serve me. That's not the mood. Yeah, the management will be very nice, Prabhupada says, when there's this mood of humility and genuine submission. Yeah, so that everybody's serving each other and we all make advancement together. So that's four things, plus constant changing is not good, that's five. And everybody should consider himself to be the servant of the other. I'll give a little, tell a little story from my own experience. Well, it's not my own experience, but I heard it from a friend. About, you know, this example when Prabhupada made that comment, Gurudas Prabhu, clean my shoes. What kind of Prabhu? It should be, can I clean your shoes? So it reminded me of a story when I was a small kid. I grew up in Northern England. So in the 1950s, that was just when the immigration into England was beginning, you know, from India, from Bangladesh, or at that time East and West Pakistan, and, you know, some of the Commonwealth countries. People from those places were starting to come and live in England and settle down. So for the English, the white population, it was a little bit of a change. Now they were getting lots of Indians and, you know, people from Africa and all over, so many places coming and settling down. So in the big cities, of course, there was lots of evidence of that. People got used to it. But where I came from in the north, it was a small town. We'd never seen anybody that wasn't white. Yeah, we had never seen a colored person. So my best friend, his name was Robert Hornsby. Bob Hornsby. He's one of the fellows that I emigrated to Australia with. So we were about 8 years old at this time. So he came to school one day and he told me that an Indian family had moved next door to his house. So they were kind of like, whoa, how do we relate to this? Yeah, he had seven brothers and sisters, big family, and this, you know, Indian family moved in. And so to help them to adjust, then his father told him a story. Then in the Second World War, there was 2 to 3 million Indian troops, actually, that were fighting on behalf of the British. They were part of the British Army, and they were fighting in Europe. So, you know, despite the fact that they were getting shot and wounded and killed and so many other things, along with the white British troops, there was still a good deal of prejudice. Because at that time the British Empire, so-called, was still intact. And India, of course, was said to be the crown jewel of the Indian Empire. And the, you know, the colonial mentality was that we're coming to make the Indians civilized. They're not very civilized, so we introduce them to meat eating and drinking and so many, you know, other activities. We'll make them civilized Europeans. So that was their idea. And so there was a fair amount of prejudice and racism, even in the ranks of the troops, despite the fact that the Indians were fighting on the same side. Some of the British troops, you know, were very arrogant and, you know, very horrible in the way they dealt with. So in this man's regiment, there was one British soldier, and he was constantly chastising and berating one of the Indian soldiers and treating him very badly, calling him names and, you know, treating him very roughly. So one morning this man woke up and he went to put on his boots, And of course in the army, it's one of the strictures there to maintain discipline. You have to keep your equipment nice and shiny and polished and clean. And nobody likes to do that. It's a chore. Yeah, having to brush it, polish your boots every day. So this man went to get his boots, and he saw that his boots were already nice and shiny and polished. And he couldn't figure out, who's done this? So he was bewildered. Who's polished my shoes? Who would do that? So then this same Indian soldier that he'd been berating and, you know, chastising and criticizing and insulting, he came forward and he very humbly said, I polished them. So then the man was so moved by this man's humility, the British soldier, that he actually started crying. And then after that, they became very good friends. So I remember that story. It was told to me when I was 8 years old. So when Prabhupada used this, you know, parody with Gurudas, Gurudas Prabhu, come and clean my boots, it reminded me of that story. And it illustrates the point very nicely that if you're very humble, then, you know, that's the best grounds for making friendship. It's the best platform that you can move forward combinedly together. But if each one is trying to lord it over the other, then you've got this constant struggle. Yeah, what Prabhupada called the leadership struggle. So we don't want that leadership struggle. Yeah, a person should be engaged in Krishna consciousness according to their particular abilities. Some people have an ability to manage things. And therefore, when Prabhupada had some men that, you know, were good managers but had problems, he didn't want to remove them. He maintained them and tried to rectify them because their natural ability was still there, despite the fact that they may have temporarily some difficulty in applying themselves properly to the standard principles of Krishna consciousness. But they have this acquired nature which makes them managers. So this is the idea, is that everybody should be engaged according to their own particular natures. If a person is put in a situation that he's not familiar with or has no expertise with or no natural ability to perform, after some time, they may do it, but after some time they'll get strained, and then that strain will become too much and then they'll crack. But if you engage somebody according to their natural propensity, gradually they'll come good. Yeah, you can purify them by their engagement in service, and their natural abilities will be used very effectively in Krishna's service. So that principle of humility, then being the servant of the other, that's very important. So 4, 5, 6 principles. And then finally another letter before we get into the bulk of the seminar. This letter was written to Yogeshwara Prabhu in June of 1971. Yogeshwara Prabhu joined, I think, in France in 1969. He was an American, actually, but he was at university in France. He met the devotees and he joined up very quickly. He's a very intelligent man, very capable person, and very soon he was given responsibility for managing the temple. And he had responsibility for organizing the Sankirtan. He had to organize the production of Prabhupada's books in the French language. So he was doing many different things, and he started to feel strained. So he wrote to Srila Prabhupada asking, well, what is the priority? You know, which services are more important than the others? And he was feeling that he could concentrate, you know, on one or two fields and let somebody else do the rest. So Prabhupada wrote back to him, and he told him, he said, we have to adjust things. Everything is important. So he was asking what's important. Prabhupada wrote back, everything is important. Not that we should do something at the expense of something else. You can't neglect something, you know, to do something else. You have to do both. So he's saying, I cannot say from here what is to be given preference. That depends on your management capacity. So that's another, you know, item of good management, recognizing the capacity that different people have to do certain things. What is their actual nature and what is their ability to apply that nature in a devotional setting. So that's where your leeway comes in. Yeah, don't change everything constantly. Keep all these different standards up. But at the same time, recognize that different people have different capacities and therefore they may need some adjustments so that they can progress ahead in their service without feeling overburdened. Yeah, if you feel overburdened, then you'll collapse. Yeah, then that will cause so much disturbance. So again, the management has to see the capability of every individual devotee, and it's that balancing the oneness with the difference, the chinchibhedabheda tattva, that we're all one in the sense that we're committed to this ISKCON movement, Krishna consciousness movement, and there's particular requirements that are there if we want to be part of this movement. We have to make some sacrifice, we have to do some austerity so that we can be part of Prabhupada's ISKCON movement. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that, you know, we're sacrificed, you know, in the fire of, you know, management, so to speak. That you have to do this, you have to do that, whether you like it or not. Within the common goals, there are also individual requirements. So in that way, achinchibhedabheda tattva, the simultaneously oneness and difference, and the balance there is what a manager is always seeking, to make sure that things go on nicely. Okay, so that's, I think, about eight principles there of management. Now what I've done is I've listed down a number of different attributes or characteristics that a manager must have in order to be successful. There's about eight or nine of these. I'll just run through the list. The first one is having clear goals, knowing what you're there for. The next one is being enthusiastic. The next one is having patience. The next one is being prepared to accept austerity. The next one is how to delegate authority. The next one is to be fiscally responsible. Yeah? Monetarily, economically responsible. The next one is to be flexible. The next one is to have genuine care for the devotees. And the final one that I've listed is using anger and chastisement, which is very easy to do in management, but it should be done very carefully. So these are a few different aspects of management. They're not the only ones, and I'm not saying that the order that I'm presenting this in is the order. They can be moved around. They're all important, but we want to look and see different examples of how Srila Prabhupada applied, you know, these different aspects or attributes and characteristics in his service. So the first thing that I'd listed was having clear goals. Very important. You can be, because Rupa Goswami, he mentions the six items that are required for being successful in Krishna consciousness. The first thing is utsahan, enthusiasm. But I've got having clear goals, because you may have lots of enthusiasm, but if you don't know how to direct it, if you don't know what the goal of your activity is, then it'll all be dissipated. So you have to first of all understand what you're trying to achieve. Yeah, where you're at, where you want to be, and how to get there. Clear goals. So Prabhupada had very, very clear goals. And they're not necessarily things that he set when he came to the West, but he'd had, you know, half his life engaged in his spiritual master's mission, and he saw the things that his spiritual master wanted to achieve, and that was his goal. In a spiritual movement, the goal of the disciple is to fulfill the desires and wishes of the spiritual master. That's it. That's the central point. Yeah. So Srila Prabhupada then, he mentions in a very interesting purport, this is from Canto 3, Chapter 22, Text 19. It's the story of Kadama Muni. And Prabhupada says in his purport, he says that in the same order as Kadama Muni, about 100 years ago, Thakur Bhakti Vinod wanted to beget a child who could preach the philosophy and teachings of Krishna, of Lord Chaitanya, to the fullest extent. By his prayers to the Lord, he had as his child Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj. And this is the key thing. Who at the present moment is preaching the philosophy of Lord Chaitanya throughout the entire world through his bona fide disciples? So this purport was written sometime in about 1972 or 1973. But Prabhupada says about his spiritual master, who at the present moment is preaching all over the world. So what does that mean? That means that Prabhupada's goal was the pleasure of his spiritual master, that's all. To allow his spiritual master's desire to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world be fulfilled through his own surrender. That was Prabhupada's mood. Not that he was taking credit for anything that he was doing. All the different targets that he had set, they were all the same things that his spiritual master had employed in the preaching of Krishna consciousness, you know, decades earlier, but which somehow or another had become spoiled when the followers of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, instead of making their guru's desire central, they somehow or another started mixing in their own visions and their own desires, and in that way things became dissipated. But for Srila Prabhupada, his preaching was simply this one thing, that he was trying to be a bona fide disciple and allow his spiritual master to preach through him all over the world. So this is a very important point. Then again, on the same idea, Prabhupada wrote a letter to Jayapataka Maharaj. This was 6th of June, 1976. At that time, Jayapataka Maharaj was working on trying to get this land acquisition in Mayapur. We had bought, I don't know exactly how much land we had at that time, but we had a fairly significant amount of land. But Prabhupada was developing this idea of having this huge Mayapur temple and then having a city for what he said would be 50,000 people to come and live there in Mayapur. So he needed a lot of land for that. So he developed this idea that he would ask the government to acquire about 300 acres of land. So acquirement means that even if the persons that are currently holding the land, even if they don't want to sell it, the government forces them to sell it, and they can only sell at a certain price.